From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. For long ages, bears have held a special place in human minds and myth. They represent power, ferocity, strength. If England is a lion, Russia is the bear. From cave bears to Beowulf, from Goldilocks to the legend of a Danish royal family descended from bears, our species has grown up with this one. Now our species threatens to overwhelm this one in old-fashioned ways and new ones, from bear baiting to bear farms to a shrinking ice cap and homes in bear country. This hour on Point, we're talking about the long history of man and bear and where it's headed now. Joining me today in the studio is international bear expert and rescuer Victor Watkins. He's a wildlife advisor with the WSPA, the World Society for the Protection of Animals. In 1990, he started the Liberty Campaign to rescue bears from captivity and mistreatment from China to India to Greece and Turkey and beyond. He's helped establish bear sanctuaries. His latest is in Romania. And he's been involved with undercover investigations into the illegal trade in bear parts. Victor Watkins, thank you very much for being here today.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be here.
And with us from Bloomington, Indiana, is Robert Beeder. He's author of the book Bear and a retired visiting professor in the Department of History and School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University. He's traveled the world studying and lecturing on bears and is currently working on a book about bear legends among Native North Americans. Robert Beeder, thank you for being here.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Professor Beeder, first to you. I mean, it's a rich and deep history, but begin to walk us into the place that bears have held in human imagination. We'll get to the way they're actually living and treated today, but in our myths and even creation stories and royal lines and the rest, what's the spectrum, the status of the bear?
Well, Tom, the bear has always had a special significance for pre-agriculturalists in the Northern Hemisphere. The human-bear relationship was very complex. Many saw bears as persons, not as human persons, but persons nevertheless. And they possessed immense spiritual power. The power was, and still is in some places of the world, are articulated through stories portraying bears as powerful sacred spirits, as ancestors, as healers, as shapeshifters, as lovers and mates. People saw themselves in bears and bears in themselves. such stories gave rise to many rites and ceremonies that were performed before going out on a hunt to hunt bears, eating of bears, disposing of their bodies after, or their remains after they've eaten the bear, and the taboos that surrounded the bear that people must obey with dire consequences if they didn't.
Remind us, I was struck by the way bears and bear references infuse our language, our national symbols, even the things we call one another, names that have been adopted in different cultures. Give us some sense of that.
Well, King Arthur, for example, the Round Table, his name comes from the Latin Arctos, which is bear. Even my own name, Robert, the B-E-R-T at the end of it, goes back to bear. There are various countries, as you mentioned, Russia is known as the bear, but also many cities. Bern in Switzerland and Madrid in Spain and Berlin in Germany all have bears as mascots or models on their coats of arms. So bears are quite ubiquitous in the language and throughout many languages, actually.
Go on.
No. The term berserk, for example, that we use to a day to point out that people have gone a bit crazy or a bit wild, comes from the berserkers of the Viking period, people who dressed up as bears or used bear skins in battle to evoke the bear, and by evoking the bear would acquire the strength and power of the bear.
And is berserk the word a reference to bear? Is the word bear embedded in it somehow?
Berserk? Yeah, bear, bear, B-E-R, mm-hmm, mm-hmm, is bear, and the rest of it, zerk, S-E-R-K, is skin.
Robert Beter, so when did the sacred begin to bleed out of the image of the bear in human culture?
Well, in some places it still hasn't. Northern Siberia, the tribes there, the Masi and the Kanti, they still are devoted to the bear. The bear is a grandfather, and they do rites and ceremonies every year that that are there to protect the people and to protect hunting and to allow them to exist as they have. You still find some of these expressions of sacredness of the bear among Lapps and among some of the people in the northern part of Scandinavia, and certainly among North American Indians, you have a great deal of devotion to the bear and fear of alienating the bear. Mm. But when the agricultural revolution set in many centuries ago, when people became moved from hunting and gathering and hunting styles to agriculture and horticulture and herding, then bears began to be obstacles, stealing apples in orchards, mm-hmm, killing pigs or goats and sheep and things like that. So bears were desacralized. But the bear still held on to a certain warrior strength, strong, fierce image. As I mentioned, the Vikings still used the bear. But many Europeans in the noble class took on the bear as a kind of totemic symbol and used them on their armor and things like that.
Robert Beter, in Bloomington, Indiana, please stand by. Victor Watkins is with me in the studio here, and I want to turn to him, if I may. Victor, you work in bear rescue, so you are very aware to how far from sacred status the bear has fallen sometimes in history and today. Give us a sense of that. When it's not being, I guess lionized is the wrong word, but held up as sacred, the downside of the bear's interaction with humankind has been pretty rough and continues to be. Give us a sense of that.
The problem today is that we've moved into the bear's backyard. We used to have a good relationship with bears long ago when there was plenty of space and plenty of food and plenty of land.
Not that they were inviolable. They were hunted.
They were hunted, but they were also respected. And currently, their habitat is being destroyed at such an enormous rate, and we're moving our industry and our agriculture and our villages and our towns into those areas. We're pushing the bears further out, and we're giving them less room to live in. And as a result, that does lead to conflicts.
So you've got an environmental problem that goes all the way up to the scale of global warming, I guess, but still at the very intimate interaction of bear and human, that's not exactly environmental. It's just human exploitation, human amusement at the expense of the bear. What are you tracking there?
Sure. Because bears have lived so close to humans in history, people have either hunted them for their meat or their claws and their teeth. Traditionally, in Asia, bears have been hunted for their gallbladder, for use in traditional medicines. And more recently, bears have been caught from the wild. They've been trained to dance, which is to catch them from the wild, and they're brought into village areas, and they're made to shuffle on their hind feet.
Put a chain on and make it perform.
Mm-hmm. And that has traditionally, again, been used by the gypsy community throughout Asia, basically to make some money. But in the modern days, these gypsies have brought the bears into tourist areas, and it's a much more commercial enterprise now. And bears are being caught to put into zoos, into circuses, into bear farms. They're used in illegal bear baiting events.
Bear farms in China, above all now, where they have ducks sort of right into the drip out the bile for sale for traditional medicinal purposes.
That's correct. In China, also in Vietnam and South Korea, bears have been used traditionally for medicinal purposes. And they, up until the 1980s, the bears were just killed in the wild, and they were caught in traps, killed, and the gallbladders cut out and sold. But in the 1980s, the Chinese devised a way to keep the bears in caged conditions, and they were able to drain the bile from the living bear, so keeping the bear in a farmed operation.
So when you talk about bear rescue, whether it's for the caged bears or bears that are destined to have their paws cut off for soup or dancing, are you actually going out sort of commando style and busting open padlocks?
Well, it varies. There are many operations around the world that we're working on different projects to protect bears in different ways. In many cases, these are illegal operations. I have to say that in China, it's not illegal. In China, bear farming is a legitimate business, and we are campaigning and trying to persuade the Chinese to change that attitude. But we are having more luck, for example, in Vietnam, where we have persuaded the Vietnamese government to eradicate bear farming.
Jackson the Dancing Bear travels on from town to town, country fairs and city bound. Children come from miles around to see the Dancing Bear, who dances everywhere.
Jackson. We're talking this hour about the long history of man and bear and where it goes in this century, looking at bear rescue. Robert Beter is my guest, author of Bear. He's a retired visiting professor in the Department of History and the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, currently working on a book about the legends of bears among Native North Americans. Victor Watkins is also here, an international expert on bears and bear rescue. He's worked to establish a number of bear refuges around the world. He's with the World Society for Protection of Animals. Robert Beter, looking here in your book, Bear, there's a fascinating timeline. I mean, it goes back literally millions of years about bears and then their relationship with humans, back to the cave bear in Europe, where humans and bear very literally shared their environment in the most direct fashion.
Yeah, I also go back all the way to dawn bear, which is Ursus salamentus, which is about 22-23 million years ago.
That's all the way back, the size of a small terrier, looked like a raccoon.
Right. And then various bears between that bear and the cave bear, and then leading into the 8 surviving species that we have now.
Always been easy here. I'm looking at during the time of Caligula, the Roman emperor, 400 bears killed in the Colosseum in one day. You also have the story of how bears may have been removed from Africa when the Carthaginians took to farming, may have wiped out every last bear in North Africa.
Yeah, there are no bears any longer in Africa. The bear today going up, in the book, I don't actually come out and say it, but my feeling is that of the 8 species that we have, probably 7 will be extinct by the end of the century, leaving only the American black bear, which seems to be gaining population now in the U.S.
You're saying on all other continents there would be no bears, or if there were, it would be some relative of the black bear?
It'll just probably be the black bear, and then if these are bears in the wild, of course. I don't mean bears in zoos and things like that.
So you mean the brown bear gone, the grizzly, the sun bear, Southeast Asia, the giant panda gone, the polar bear gone, sloth bear of India, Bangladesh, Nepal, spectacled bear of South America, all those gone you're expecting?
I predict this. I hope I'm wrong, but I predict this. And it's not only the loss of habitat that was mentioned, because this affects things like the brown bear, the polar bears, the pandas. The rainforest are being cut down. Spray from airplanes to kill the cocoa plantations and the rebels in the backcountry feeding on the spectacle bear. The spectacle bear is very much at risk.
This in South America, the bear with the kind of raccoon-style black around the eyes.
White
around the eyes, excuse me, yeah.
Looks like glasses. And the sun bear has long disappeared from many of its ancient haunts. The sloth bear and the Asian black bear are used for well, it's pointed out for medicine, for gallbladder, for bear paw soup, various other bear parts, plus their habitat is disappearing. As people need land in places like India and various other places and are moving into bear habitats, cutting down the forest. In the Arctic, we've already seen the disappearance of pack ice. The polar bears are going to be hard put to be able to survive without the pack ice. And then also you have the pollution of the oceans. A lot of the polar bears just eat the fat of various animals, ring mm-hmm. seals, mm-hmm. their favorite thing, and then also salmon. And that's where PCBs and dioxins and mercury end up congregating in the fat cells of these animals, and of course the bear with the at the top of the food chain eating and most of the time with seals they just eat the fat and the skin and leave the meat. There's a reason for this physiologically for the polar bear, but when they eat all this fat, then they become the end point of all these poisons that are found in the ocean. And you got polar bears north of Norway that are found hermaphrodites, which, you know, they have double sexual organs and stuff like that. So,
wow.
So these kinds of things. Global warming, as I said, has affected a lot of the food for our grizzly bears, the white bark pine, other things, the cutworm moths.
So here's a very, very, very long relationship that may be on the verge of being severely reduced. I want to begin to hear from our listeners.
And then poaching.
Well, and we'll look at that with Victor Watkins again as well. But let me take a call first from Simsbury, Connecticut. Ray, hi, you're on the air, Ray.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just wanted to report to you that about 5 years ago in our small town, there was, you know, it was very rare for anybody to see a bear.
Mm-hmm.
And now we live on the edge of the woods, and we now have a black bear that comes to the backyard quite often. And I've gotten to just appreciate the beauty of this beautiful glistening black bear, and I put a board up on a tree in the backyard, and I nail some peanut butter sandwiches there for him, and he'll come about once or twice a week and eat the peanut butter sandwiches, and we just love having him around.
What kind of neighborhood are you in, Ray? Is it a suburb, or are you out in the countryside?
It's suburb and countryside. We live on a 500-acre back to a school that has this just these woods and the paths that go through it that everybody walks on every day. But there's obviously one or two black bears who live back there.
And when you nail that PBJ to the board for the bear, I mean, how do you look at that? Is it like drawing birds to a bird feeder? Are you doing the bear a favor? Do you worry that he's going to come in and want to get it right out of your fridge?
My wife does, but I don't, because I know they're not going to attack you, and I just love seeing this beautiful, it weighs between 400 and 500 pounds, and it's just a beautiful black bear, and it actually even ignores my little 12-pound terrier that barks at it when it comes to the tree.
So you hope, so you're just about ready to pet the pussycat here, but it's a big one.
It's still a wild animal, and yeah, we respect that. But at the same time, we just love seeing him.
Ray, thank you very much for that report. Victor Watkins, a couple of things here. First of all, Ray's saying, I'd never seen a bear. Now they're in my backyard. Secondly, what about the nature of this interaction? Does this bode well for bears or ill?
Well, I can understand his appreciation of the bear. And this is part of the problem. People do want to see bears, and when bears do come into urban situations, and people make a mistake of thinking that they're not perhaps as wild or as dangerous as they may be. I can give you a good example. I've just come back from Romania.
Mm.
We're working there with the government and with the local NGOs to create what we call a bear sanctuary.
Mm-hmm.
We're rescuing and confiscating 50 or more bears, which have been kept in illegal captivity. And these are bears which people have caught from the wild as cubs. People catch cubs. Where bears live in the wild with people in the suburbs, bear cubs can often be orphaned for many reasons.
To do what with them?
Well, they put them, it's a cute little cub, they put him in a cage, they may use them as an attraction outside a restaurant. But that's part of the problem. Also in Brasov, in central Romania, working on another problem there, where bears are coming out of the forests and they're eating from the trash cans, which are right next to the forest. This has been going on for many years, and people in the local area have seen it as an entertainment. They've gone up, they've taken photographs, tourists go up there, and people even go up to these bears and try to feed them. Now, these are wild animals, and the trouble is that they've been encouraged to come out of the wild. They find an easy source of food. And it does give the bears a less of a problem with people, which could eventually lead to a real problem.
But they're at least running up against a kind of benevolent intent, whatever its effect
may
be. But you're talking about plenty of people who have anything but a benevolent intent, who are chopping off those paws for a bowl of soup or jamming in a kind of a catheter into the gallbladder to drip bile. I mean, it's very rough at the other end of this business.
It's really rough, and that's because bears and their products and their use have been... wide use around the world. Bears have been caught all over Europe and Asia for use as dancing bears because once we've brought a wild bear onto the street, it is a very interesting thing to see. It can be entertaining to some people's eyes to see this majestic creature under the control of people.
Where does that go on? I mean, I know from pictures in Robert's book that in Paris a few decades ago, you could still see it on the streets of Paris, dancing bears, but today, where?
Well, we started work on the first dancing bear campaign in the early 90s. There were dancing bears used throughout Greece and in Turkey and Bulgaria. That's mainly the areas in Europe. By the end of the 1990s, we'd eradicated dancing bears from Greece and Turkey with the government. We'd helped them to confiscate them. We put them into sanctuaries.
Mm-hmm.
But there still are dancing bears today being used in India and Pakistan, and it's a big problem there.
Do you consider it very cruel?
It is very cruel. The bears are caught from the wild often to catch, and they're caught as cubs because the cubs can be trained. The mother bears are often killed to get the cubs.
Mm.
Now, to train a bear to dance or to be in your control, once they are large and they've grown up, they're a very powerful animal, and you can't just ask the bear to sit up and dance. What they tend to do is to subdue the animal by pain and by fear.
Mm.
In India, for example, they will drill a hole through the top of the nose and put a rope through it, and it comes out of the mouth. And just by pulling on the rope is very, very painful to that animal. From a very young age as a cub, it's then taught that if you pull on the string and if you play music, then it has to stand up and shuffle around. And it learns this all its life. If it doesn't do that, then it may get a whack on the back with a stick.
It gets rougher. There's a kind of bear fighting, the equivalent of a dog fight in Pakistan very recently, maybe even now.
It is. And a bear
How does that work? What is that?
Well, bear baiting used to be, and I'm sorry to say, it used to be a tradition throughout Europe and also in England.
A bear baiting. That phrase has different meanings. In North America, sometimes it means you put out jelly donuts to bring the bear for hunters to shoot at.
That's right. That's baiting for hunting. This is baiting for a sport where you bait an animal against another one. In Pakistan, what happens, the bears are, again, they're used by the gypsies, but they're paid to bring them into an arena by the wealthy landlords of Pakistan. The bears are tied to maybe a 10-length rope of rope to an arena. Then they have a 10-meter area to run around in.
Okay.
Two very powerful pit bull type of dogs are then let loose on this bear. The bear knows he can't escape. The only option is for the bear to stand up and try to fight off these powerful animals. This only lasts a few minutes. But as you can imagine...
What happens at the end? Pull the dogs out, or the bear is killed, subdued?
No, they very rarely a bear dies. These are very tough, very powerful
animals.
So
what happens?
They get incredibly bruised and battered, and the photographs of the bears afterwards, they look like boxes where the heads and the faces are so bloody.
The dogs go after their muzzle, their face.
Absolutely. And even the dogs, of course, get badly injured, but very rare do you get a death here. It's a sport, it lasts for a few minutes, the bears try to keep the dogs away, the dogs try to pull the bear down.
Are you stopping that somehow, or does it just go on?
We're working very well. It's taken a number of years. First of all, the Pakistan authorities didn't see it as a priority. But in actual fact, in Pakistan, this is illegal under the animal welfare law. It's illegal under the Islamic law as well. It's forbidden to bait animals to fight in Pakistan. So the government is now supporting us. We are starting to clear it up.
Let's hear from a listener, Sally, calling from Boise, Idaho. Hi, Sally, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. Hi.
I just wanted to comment. I've known Victor and Wisp's work for a lot of years. I work with orphan bear cubs here in Idaho and the western states, and I've gotten to know the spirit of this animal, and it breaks my heart when I hear of the cruelties going on elsewhere. And also, more importantly, you know, when they start killing off other populations, then the poaching on our black bear becomes greater, and that really concerns me, even though our population isn't threatened right now. So I just wanted to thank Victor and Wista and everyone working so hard on behalf of bears.
Well, that's good of you. What about the, you say poaching, Sally. What about straight-up hunting? I mean, bear hunting is legal in great parts of North America. I saw a number of something like 40 or 50,000 bears killed, hunted by legal hunting in a single year in North America. How do you look at that?
Well, I grew up in a family of hunters. I don't hunt. I don't like hunting. And perhaps if I felt hunting could be eliminated, I might be out there fighting for it. But I'm a realist, and I don't think hunting's going to stop, at least here in Idaho. So I just have to deal with it, because the cubs that we release are sometimes shot by hunters later on in later years. And it's just a reality that you have to work with.
Mm. Sally, thanks for calling. Victor, there's a thumbs up from Boise, Idaho.
Yeah, hi, Sally. I know Sally very well. We've been working together for at least the last 10 years. She's doing amazing work, fantastic work with the Idaho Black Bear Rehab. She's taken in, I think, over 150 black bear orphaned cubs, and we've released them back to the wild.
Typically orphaned by hunting, hunters having killed their
mother? It can be a variety of reasons. It can be by hunting or forest fires or traffic accidents. It's a variety of reasons. Mm-hmm. But you'll always find orphaned bears in countries where there's quite a significant population. And I must say, the work that we're doing with people like Sally, which is to rehabilitate and release back to the wild these orphaned bear cubs, has really been shown significantly to help these animals. In the past, I must say, even 5 years ago, we had a lot of problem even convincing bear specialists that bear cubs could be put back into the wild successfully. And we've shown it with groups like with Sally's. We've put them back in the wild, we've put radio collars on them, and it's proven that they do survive very well. And we're now trying to duplicate this in many countries around the world.
Mm-hmm. Robert Beter, how do you look at the work of someone like Victor Watkins? He's going out, you know, bear by bear, trying to save them from cages or bear farms. You're talking about wholesale destruction of species over time. Does it make this work look unimportant to you, or how do you see it?
No, I think that what he's doing is wonderful, and people that are doing similar kinds of things is wonderful. I think that as long as we can keep bears with us, the better off we are as humans. And I think that this becomes very important. I wanted to mention a little bit about the bear dancing. Years ago, Russia and Lithuania used to be the important areas for training bears to dance. And the way they would do it was build a fire and then put a metal plate over the fire and then had the bear stand on the metal plate. Oh. And then they'd play music, and then the bear had to keep moving his feet in order to so they wouldn't burn. Yeah. This was one of the more common ways of doing it, along with the rope thing that Victor mentioned.
Oh, it's a terrible image. We'll come back and hear more, if we may. Robert Beter, please stand by in Bloomington, Indiana, and Victor Watkins from the World Society for the Protection of Animals with us in quite a different vein. Here's the bear hunting song of the Naskapi Indians of Canada. We're talking about the history of man and bear and where it's going. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the long history of man and bear and where it goes in this century, talking about bear rescue. Don's calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Hi, Don, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
This reminds me of when Andre Codescu, the Romanian-American poet, had asked the question, where would all the bearness go if all the bears were gone, when the last animal in the Sarajevo Zoo, which was a bear, brown bear, had starved to death? I think for Europeans and Americans and other northern peoples, the bear plays a huge role in our connection with nature and with our ancestral past. It, loss of the bear would probably do more to break those, you know, our connections to our history and to the other creatures than any other loss of any other animal.
Yeah, I was thinking just down that vein, Don, and I'm glad you raise it, especially after hearing these stories. I mean, Robert Beter, you've spent years immersed in all of this deep, long-lived mythology. Now you're describing potentially 7 out of 8 bear species being gone in this century. At a kind of mythic, psychic level, what do we lose if we lose those bears? For that matter, have we already lost it?
We've lost part of ourselves, I think. Part of, as your caller mentioned, part of our history. For example, I think of Faulkner's story, The Bear, in which the bear represents the frontier. And once the bear is killed, you know, the frontier is gone. I mean, in Faulkner's mind, that the
Old
bear
Ben.
So closely represented the this frontier that we had that was part of our national psyche that was always there. But it's very difficult in today's world when a bowl of bear paw soup in a restaurant in Seoul costs $750. When peasants in China and Southeast Asia and Taiwan can get $2,700 for a bear when they live on maybe $500 a year. Mm. In some cases, you can get $10,000 a bear. And the people that live around the refuges in bear parks in places like India and other places, they're under constant requests by bear dealers, merchants, black market dealers to go in and get some bears. And some of these parks, there's a park in Thailand that was filled with 60 bear hunters camped out in the park.
And we're talking also, even in North America, bears found now in the wild with just their paws removed, their
gallbladder
cut out, heart cut out.
Right. And this is now getting to now in South America, where the peasants down there find that they can catch these spectacle bears, cut off their paws, and also send their gallbladders. The bile is worth now about the same price as heroin. So you can see that there's a mass market, that there's a market in this, and it's a black market. And the people that deal in this also deal in arms and moving people, in drugs, in prostitution. They're regular mafias. And some of the conservation agents in places like Cambodia and various other places cannot stand up to them because they just don't have the military power. And these people that are selling these things know all the loopholes in the laws, and they work them very well.
So there's a terrible diminishment of the bears, but I'm also struck here at the diminishment of humans that may come with that. I mean, you describe story after story where the mythic human sense of itself is magnified by the existence, by the interaction with this creature.
Yes. Yes, they in the past they identified the bear was their brother, and the bear was partly human. One Indian woman pointed out that we are the bear and the bears are us. So you have this identity with the people. This is gone. This is lost, and somehow we really have to get this back, not only with bears but with many other animals that are on the edge.
Let's take a call from Virginia Beach. Virginia, Sherry, you're on the air. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, I've had some amazing experiences with bears, and I grew up in Montana, and they're relatively well-known and common, you know, anywhere around there.
Sure.
But in 1971, my husband and I went off to be hippies in the National Forest in Oregon, and I had an encounter with a bear. We kind of had a lean-to pitched, and we'd made a little table, and we were vegetarian, so we had all our dried fruit and nuts and everything, month's supply of food.
Bear food.
I woke up in the middle of the night, and I looked over, and I saw these bear legs.
Oh.
And I stood up, and I was facing the bear across the table.
Oh.
And that bear, I'll tell you, I don't know how anybody can think they're cuddly. I mean, they just have to half-slap you, and you're done. He was not afraid of me. He kind of went down by the river, and he sat there all night like he was trying to decide whether I was worth it, and I was just making a bunch of noise and everything because we didn't have guns.
Oh. Well, we're glad you and the bear both survived that one. What does it leave you thinking, feeling about the bear, Sherry?
Well, you know, I mean, the thing is, leave them in the wild. They, you can't train them. They're going to do whatever they want. They're very wonderful, gorgeous things, but we were never happy to see a bear come around when we were camping because that meant they were coming back and they were going to take whatever they wanted, and he did eventually get our food.
Yeah, I don't doubt it, and you're probably happy to have him take that instead of anything else. But thanks for sharing that. Robert Beter, you've got stories in here out of European tradition in particular about the interaction of bears and women, even to the point of kind of amorous relations, or where is it a bear or man or both? What's the mythology there?
Well, bears, both in Europe and really in North America, among Indian tales, stories of women who marry bears, and in some cases, men who marry bears. But in Europe, it's it goes way back, back in the 1500s. Bishop in Uppsala,
Sweden.
Sweden pointed out that a young, beautiful maiden was stolen by a bear and then made pregnant, and then the bear eventually was killed by local farmers, but the boy became was basically human, but he had the strength of a bear, and then he since became the head of the Danish royal family. But there are many stories of this, and I think partly it's the medieval credibility, credulousness of bears, and bears are very human-like.
Sure.
Bears are plantigrade. I mean, they walk like us. They say when you skin a bear and you look at it, the skeleton, the whole thing looks very human-like. So that there's a, I think over a long period of time, people have seen the bear as being very close to being human.
Not always a pretty story. I mean, we have a kind of gussied up version of Goldilocks, but 1837, Goldilocks and the Three Bears, you remind us that the Goldilocks story ended up very badly for Goldilocks in a number of its traditional tellings.
Yeah, and the first in the first Goldilocks, there was an old woman who slept in the bear's bed, ate the bear's porridge, and then they found out about it, and they chased her, and they tried to drown her. She wouldn't drown. They tried to burn her, and she wouldn't burn. And so they flung her up in the air, and she landed on the spike or the spire of St. Paul's Cathedral in London, and that actually killed her. Fortunately, St. Paul does not have a spire, but anyways, the story goes that, you know, that the bears were very human in this. The bears were very human in this, and living in a house with chairs and tables and porridge and things like that. Mm. And many of the fairy tales, east of the moon, west of the sun, Scandinavian tale, and various other tales, all see the bear as, you know, as almost human, and the bear takes, and then sometimes the bear turns into a prince after, you know, after a certain amount of time after the marriage, and so you have this kind of thing of the beast turning into a prince. And
1894, Rudyard Kipling gives us The Jungle Book and Baloo. 1902, the first teddy bear made in Brooklyn, New York. That fascination with the kind of anthropomorphic, cuddly side of the cub, but it's not all cuddly now, that's for sure. Andrew's calling from Boonville, New York. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hey. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
Yeah, we've been living in the Adirondacks for about 20 years now, and over the past 10 years, we've been seeing a proliferation of bears, especially with, you know, the hot summers like this past summer.
Mm-hmm.
I should say hot and dry summers, and I got a couple of good stories, I think, to share with your listeners.
Please.
They'll appreciate. We've got a freezer in the garage, and the first time that the bear hit the freezer this summer, I woke up and I have an office in the barn, and I was coming out and there was garbage all over in the morning. So, you know, of course the next night we closed the garage door.
Yeah.
Wake up in the morning, same situation, the door's halfway up. So I asked my wife if the kids went out and had opened the door or whatever, and we looked at the door and the bear prints are on the door. So the bear opened the door. The third time it struck, we went away on vacation. We just filled the freezer. We come home a week later, and he had emptied the freezer. So part of the story is, the bear is coming close enough, and, when the berries, from the hot weather there, there's really nothing to eat. They're coming close to the homes, and it's not just the garbage. They're actually going into the freezers.
And in California, we hear into kitchens, but this seems quite a gentlemanly or womanly bear opening the garage door instead of just banging it down or tearing the freezer door off.
Right, and that's one of the reasons why we don't lock the freezer door. Because they'll tear it right off.
I've seen that on the North Slope in Alaska in oil camps there where the bears would come in after the workers left and just had a jamboree with the ice cream freezer. Great big ones torn right off the hinges. Andrew, thanks for those stories from Boonville. Let's get some more from Ware, New Hampshire. Walter, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you today?
All right. What do you know?
Well, we had a bear visit us yesterday at about 5 o'clock in the morning. The outside light, motion detector light came on, and he decided to raid the bird feeder that was put out a little too soon this year.
Yeah.
So I opened the window and yelled at him, and he ran off. And then last evening, about 5 o'clock, looked out the slider, and he was laying on the front lawn eating some apples off the apple tree and decided to take a nap right there.
So do you want conservation or chase those buggers away?
Well, I think that they should be left alone. I could have called the authorities, and they probably would have come over and done a dastardly thing. But instead, it's just better to chase them off and take precautions. Don't leave things out for them to get at, and try to discourage them coming back if possible so that you don't have an unfortunate incident, both for family or pets or yourself. Or the bear.
Yeah, it's very close proximity. We can hear it right in your yard yesterday. Let's get another call from Gardner, Montana. Tom, you're on the air.
Hello, Tom.
Hi.
I've got a couple of things to say. First of all, we've had 5 grizzly bear maulings in the last 2 months in this area.
Wow.
Mostly hunters going out and just surprising the bears.
Mm,
but
okay.
There seems to be more and more these days. Also, the habituation of bears to humans. Like your caller earlier, he said that he put peanut butter out on his tree and it coaxed the bear in. Most of the vehicles in this town have bumper stickers that says, "A fed bear is a dead bear."
In other words, don't train them to come in close because that's the path to a shooting, maybe.
They start to see food with humans, mm-hmm. and they come down out of the hills to get food, and they end up getting killed, mainly because they get habituated to it and they associate food with humans. So they come down to the yards to people, and they start getting in trouble. And that's when the Park Service, the Forest Service,
right.
they go out and kill the bear.
Ends up a rough path for everyone. Tom, thanks very much for calling. Robert Beter, our time grows short, but your words of warning ring so loudly in our ears. The idea of losing 7 out of 8 major bear species in this century is kind of sad beyond words. If we were to really try and push back against that, what would it take?
I think it would take actual setting aside vast areas for bears, forest, stream, meadows, and things like that, where bears could feel safe from humans. I think your callers have pointed out that the last caller has about feeding bears. I think that this is always wrong because the bears, if they don't get food, they can turn ugly. Mm-hmm. Lots of times they invade garbage dumps, partly because their habitat is shrinking, and they end up eating car batteries and other kinds of things that has been noted up in Churchill, Manitoba, where polar bears gather, and this kills them, and other kinds of toxic oil cans and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I think that you have to either cull bears or set aside larger spaces for bears. It was an attempt to open up a corridor between Yellowstone and Canada so that you could have a genetic development. You could
keep the pool rich.
Right. And this was denied by the present administration because ranchers and farmers didn't like it. But the bears are being caught in smaller and smaller areas, and bears are naturally scavengers, they will raid campgrounds and things like that. But the bear needs more space to move out. And
will you remind us in this hour of how important that is and how long that history is? We haven't solved it, but as bears head toward hibernation, you put us very much with them in mind, and we're grateful for that. Robert Beter, author of Bear, thank you for joining us. And Victor Watkins with the World Society for the Prevention of Animals, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you very much.
We'll go out with Lyle Lovett and Bears. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
It's time to see a bear with pay fee. For me, I just bear up to my bewildered best. And some folks even seen a bear in me. So I meet a bear and take him on out to lunch with you. Even though your friends may stop and stare.